orchestral excerpt plays back cleanly, it will serve as a final check of the system's freedom from distortion.
While many people remember that the Manhattan Project was the code name for the attempt of 8 New York City bartenders to develop a cocktail of whiskey and vermouth, but which, when a jigger of bubbly uranium-235 was accidentally dropped into the shot glass, serendipitously resulted in creation of the atomic bomb just in time to turn the tide of the Nuremberg War, few recall that the effort to mass-produce the first spatially non-symmetric subatomic wiener was codenamed the Manhasset Project, after Sol Burdock's Long Island Deli, where the meat byproduct in a bun was introduced to an unsuspecting public in 1971. Although dissimilar in many respects, the Manhattan Project, for example, spent umpteen hundreds of thousands of your tax dollars on research and bar tabs, while the Manhasset Project was kept afloat by a $450 loan from Saul's brother Grobner's taxidermy shop in Queens. The two clandestine endeavors had more in common than 82% of their syllables. Both were spectacular bombs. It may seem quite a stretch from wiener bombs to Aram Khachaturian's saber dance, especially when Carl Jung, Stan Getz, and Nancy Sinatra have petitioned to appear in the equation. But bear in mind that Grobner's taxidermic function, which also figures in the recipe, is the metaphysical equivalent of Anything Can Happen Day on the old Mickey Mouse Club television program. Love those dancing sabers.
Want to hear them again?
Sure. Exactly 10 years before the Grobner taxidermic loan, Nancy Sinatra had reached her symbolic 21st birthday. They go together quite well, don't you think?
Yes, yes, it's a high fidelity. That's modern.
Yeah, as we are.
Taxidermy.
Right, exactly. That's where we were.
Yes,
exactly 10 years before the Grobner taxidermic loan, Nancy Sinatra had reached her symbolic 21st birthday, having spent the last 3 years crooning songs about wax clad in leather culottes. Stan Getz was planting and sculpting briar shrubbery in the shape of saxophones outside of a cemetery in Paris, France, for reasons that remain unknown to this day. And Carl Jung, who might have been able to shed some light on Getz's particular behavior had the latter's insurance premiums been paid up and he could have scheduled a session with the good head doctor, had, after concluding a lengthy series of unsuccessful matter transference experiments in which he had hoped to instantly transport himself at will miles away from E.M. Forster, a bothersome neighbor, decided to leave his current time-space continuum and continued life in the only parallel universe known to man, a universe, curiously enough, in which Khachaturian's saber dance plays the role of both genial host and tormentor.
That took me far away from a potential pun. About that saxophone and the briar, what?
The briar, Stan Briar? No. Stenbriar Man?
No. It's toward the top of the thing. You said something about a briar...
Planting and sculpting briar shrubbery in the shape of saxophones.
Yes, briar-tone saxophones. I knew about that. Long way to get that pun. But back to the tune.
By employing Grabner's taxidermic function, which will one day be discussed at length, we discover that Mrs. Sinatra's songs about wax bear an uncanny rhythmic kinship to saber dance. And when the wind blows through Mr. Getz's saxophonic shrubbery, the third pluperfect saber dance theme is heard in startling retrograde motion. Carl Jung, meanwhile, has elected to remain silent on the matter. But how then do the subatomic Wiener bombs, known in many a discredited circle as Le Flambeau Orient, fit into the formula? It's simple.
I knew it would be.
In fact, too simple to bother revealing. On this 107th episode of Calvo Sindamian's New Music Bazaar, this portion of which forgot to take its Prozac today, and therefore should not be held responsible or accountable for should not be held responsible for that last bit of literary bewilderment on radio. From Stan Getz, meanwhile, the path is clear to Nancy Sinatra and even on to Carl Jung, but the return trek to Nancy and Stan, by way of Aram Khachaturian and his brother, Cole Porter, must pass through the subatomic clutches, and Godspeed to you all of Calvus.
Sing-along now.
This is a sing-along piece. Didn't you used to play this in rhythm band? See and hear where James Tenney received his what? What did he receive? Dare we say inspiration?
Yes. Say it.
No, I daren't. Wow.
The saber dance through the field of broken tennies. Aram Khachaturian and James Tenney's music for player piano. Well,
I may have to explain this later.
Which part?
The equation.
Yes, I think you should explain the equation later. Because,
much later.
It's very difficult for me to follow at the very moment of its explication. Sometimes, you know, when I read them in books, I understand them. But not when they're first presented.
Right.
Not when the saxophone is being sculpted, as it were. Today is the 107th episode of Calvo's and Damien's New Music Bazaar. It is also the second part of our interview with, what's his name? Oswald.
Somehow I thought last week was the second.
How did that happen, that you thought that?
I neglected to bring any plundered tunes.
Well, we have the rest. You didn't keep them at home, did you?
Keep what?
A plundered tomb. Tunes.
Tombs, yes.
A plundered tombs of Nefertiti. That is the theme of our show, the plundering of the tomb of Nefertiti by John Oswald and Aram Khachaturian as they sat by the riverside listening to James Tenney babble.
Wow.
I think we should listen. We have new releases. I think before we go to the James Tenney, the John Oswald.
We could do
James
Tenney
that.
Too.
Yes, I suppose we could. We do have him coming up, or did we broadcast that already?
One or the other.
I don't recall.
People look on the internet and they can tell us.
Let's be clear.
No, never.
We have an interview with John Oswald, part two today, during which we'll hear a wonderful, wonderful thing. We'll hear the case of death.
Oh.
The Plunderphonics of Agatha Christie.
Right. Oh, that is.
Which is actually quite good.
Yes.
And we'll hear a few other of the excellent John Oswald pieces as opposed to some of the less than excellent John Oswald pieces. And but we have new releases. We have the new... Here,
oh, open it right
yes,
now.
Opening it right here. New music from Seamus, which is the Society of...
Detectives.
Of Detectives, yes. Society for... I can't even open it. It's one of these things. Society for Electroacoustic Music in the United States. And I still can't open the package. I hate this. Right on the air, I cannot open the package that I to play. Well, I tell you what. Oh, somebody with good fingernails is here. Half of them are painted, and half of them are not painted.
But,
she's also having.
Why don't you play the other one?
The other one's also sealed. They're both sealed. Both new releases sealed. All right.
Doesn't matter. You can play something else. How about some more Aram Khachaturian? That seemed to be popular.
I'll play a very, very brief other piece of Plunderphonics, a Kyrie from Kiss Closed My Eyes by Laurel MacDonald. How about that? Because that's a dandy little piece, a little bit different from the usual. And the cellophane or whatever this stuff is has just come off. But let's listen to Kiss Closed My Eyes.
Thank you.
fading quietly off into the distance. That's Laurel McDonald from Kiss Closed My Eyes. I can't say it. Kiss Closed My Eyes. That was Kyrie, the opening cut of that.
Sounded like a rapper that had gone to sleep.
Cellophane?
That too. We hear cellophane.
That's what we couldn't get off the other CDs. That's she considers herself what? You read this interesting word, an audio...
Oh,
extraction artist or something?
It was in there somewhere.
Something like that. She's among the Plunderphonia relatives.
Plunderphony? Plunderrealists?
Plunderrealists. Among the Plunderrealists. Well, we finally got the wrapper off our Music from Seamus, Volume 6, so we get to hear how old new music can continue to sound in the hands of the experts, those people who...
They're just hearkening back to a softer, quieter, friendlier time.
This is scary. You know, I'm a member of this organization. I've been ashamed to submit anything because it doesn't sound like any of this stuff.
So it's S-H-A-M-E-U-S.
Yes, that's for sure. All right, let's listen to the from the brand new release from Seamus, the Society for Electroacoustic Music in the United States. This is Cellar, C-E-L-L-A-R, Cellar by Eleni Lilios.
I think some of these modern composers think all the musical ideas have been used up, so why not go back and dig out
and
some
use
old
some
ideas?
More. Yeah. Yes. Sure. Eleni Lilios, that's Seller, and gosh, we're gonna just move right along from that to another brand new release of marginal
Something happened there. Didn't you hear something?
Yes, something. We'll bring it up. There. This is Danaka Denahi, Metropolis Mutabilis. We'll listen to a little bit of that, and then we'll go to something else after that. And we won't announce that until afterwards, because that'll be our quiz. 454-7762 to join in the quiz, which will happen in about 3 minutes when the music changes. Let's put that in air quotes.
Right.
For those who actually missed the transition there, and it's not hard to do, it happened about 3 minutes ago. Well, no calls on that quiz.
What was the question?
Well, the question was...
Why play this?
Why play this, basically, yeah. The previous piece was Dermach Denehy's Metropolis Mutabilis from 1996. The transition so smooth that I didn't even know where the knobs were when I was turning them. Into Hymnen by Karlheinz Stockhausen from November 30th, 1967.
See, the analogy that comes to mind is, say, 604 tractor trailers armed and dangerous and brakeless coming down Sullivan Hill in Roxbury Town as opposed to Roxbury Village. And on the bottom is a member of the current...
Compositional electronic generation.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Pushing an out-of-gas moped with an 8-track sound system.
Yes.
And
it's quite an image.
Okay.
I kind of agree with that. I don't think the time between, say, 1770 and 1800, the 30 years in that time, showed less progress in terms of musical concept and execution than this shows. I mean, here we have the innovation of 1967, and right across from it, as I turn this knob up, wrong cut, but...
Who would know?
Oh, yes, because it's the wrong composer. Well, anyway, I took that one out of the CD player, but you almost couldn't tell. The sort of, I think what Stockhausen called them was formants. He created shapes on which he based pieces. And the notion of working with shapes seems to continue, but almost nothing of imagination. And here we dare say these things on this very airwave, the one coming from WGDR, Plainfield.
Oh, how very clever.
How clever, yes. But it seems so. Stockhausen, of course, I suppose, people call a genius because of his imagination and because of his ability to create a piece like this, one with radios and electronic sounds and excerpts of national anthems. Yet, is it the end? Is there nothing more to come out of the concept of formant electronics or that other than simple noises? His music had a shape. This piece is 2 hours long, and you get to the end of it, and you feel you've listened to a whole piece of music. And those other pieces somehow seem to be little feeble snippets.
Feeble snippets. That's it. Not that we're judging these feeble composers.
No, I guess not. But well, anyway, there it is. That's feeble snippets. And let's move now back to our interview with John Oswald.
Speaking
in Toronto,
of
yes. And just sort of underneath the music by Stockhausen, the Hymnen, which will go away, we'll be hearing Plecture, the conclusion of Plecture by John Oswald, which is where we kind of left off in our interview last week.
Thank you. Partly because Finnegan's Wake, I think, is an inspirational source for kind of both just sheer complexity, but also this dialectic complexity of some plexure.
We're just playing the plexure shell game here. find the quotes.
Surrounded by listenable snippets, I could just stay here all day.
I know, this must be an unbearable ecstatic moment for you.
I don't even have to drop the 8-track needle.
That's true.
Take I always have to think of what to do with all these noisy cellophane wraps.
Well, just let them come in. Wrap away. What else are you working on? We'll listen to some more of the Plunderphonics at various of our shows as we move in and out of when we get to this interview in real time. What else are you working on, and what else led you to be working in this area?
I've just finished a radio play for the Dutch National Radio called Brazilians, which...
How many Brazilians? Just a lot of... hundreds of Brazilians or thousands?
That's the title, Brazilians.
All right. So I just didn't want to have a conflict here.
What do you think?
Just number an unnamed number of Brazilians is fine for me, but I have a...
There are, in fact...
Uh-oh.
I was going to say four. There are three Brazilians.
Three Brazilians is fine.
Okay.
Yes.
That's okay.
There's a German Brazilian. There's a Portuguese Brazilian. And there's... the Dutch person is not... Two Brazilians. A Canadian. Me. And a Dutch radio person. The play exists in mainly four languages. The speaking part for me is in English. It's performed by an actress, Valerie Bougiar. And the Portuguese-Brazilian parts, there's several characters, both men and women, are performed by a Brazilian man. There's several German parts for some Germans who are living in Brazil, are all performed by a German man. And the Dutch radio guy, who's always on the telephone, is performed by a Dutch woman. So the play exists in these four languages where everybody's speaking in their indigenous language. And it's based on a more or less true story in which almost all the dialogue that has been recreated here in the play was spoken in English, but we've gone back to the indigenous languages of the various people involved. So there were several projects I worked on last year that had to do with multiple languages at the same time, and kind of going for, I guess, an international feel, and also trying to see where there were points of decipherability, even if you weren't polyglot, and just like you and knew what all these languages were.
Right.
Are you concerned with the kind of acoustic event in there as well as the linguistic one? Is that your composer's interest, the sounds of the different sounds?
Well, I was originally commissioned by the Dutch radio to do a soundscape piece based in Brazil, and after quite a bit of coaxing, they sent me down to Brasilia, Sao Paulo, and Rio de Janeiro for 3 days each, which has been compressed into 1 day each in the play, just to get the flavor. You know, originally they called me up and said, John Oswald, we want you to take Brazilian records and do Plunderphonics. We send you to Brazil to buy some records. And I said, well, you know, I can buy Brazilian records in Toronto. As it turns out, they are much more available in Toronto than I was able to find in Brazil. So that was the most practical solution. But they wanted me to get the flavor of it. What happened as a result was my stay there was so bizarre that I found after about a 3-year hiatus, in which I didn't do any piece at all, that every time I came back to the idea of fulfilling the commission, I kept thinking in terms of the story rather than a sonic piece about Brazil. And I didn't have any great connection to Brazilian music. As I stated in the play, you know, there's sambas and bossa novas and the girl from Ipanema, and that's about it. But, and it is a rich musical culture, so I was not somebody that was suitable for representing that.
This is the one piece, though, Why Brazil?
Why Brazil? That was their idea. Yeah, the first.
Why was it their idea?
Yeah.
Did you ever find that out?
Well, it's part of the intrigue of this play is why does the Dutch radio want a Canadian to go to Brazil and be hosted there by Germans, totally by Germans, in order to create some sort of sonic reference to Brazil.
It's clear to me, but I don't want to spoil it for the rest of our audience, so go right ahead.
So the play is this investigation, and it does have all sorts of sonic elements and kind of conundrum that is in a way anti-radio. As soon as you're dealing with spoken elements and anything else in radio, the spoken element should be dominant. And that's traditional, proper production. There are various things built into Brazilians that I guess would make the listener suspicious as to the capability of the producer, which is me. There are also various things to confuse the listening audience as a whole. If you listen to the piece in stereo as opposed to mono, in certain scenes you get a completely different picture because there's absolute out-of-phase elements built into the sound that cancel each other out in mono. So a mono listener might hear a dialogue that is completely masked by a environmental element in the stereo version. Stuff like that. There's all sorts of tricks. And there's places where the voices become a chorus or a babble of people trying to say things. There's the multiple languages without any sort of support of translation. And what I've suggested to them, and as far as I know, they haven't broadcast this yet, that they make available the script in its multiple translations for the Dutch audience, which in any case has a much greater facility with English and German than, for instance, an American audience would have with Dutch and German and Portuguese.
Look forward to hearing that.
I don't know. Vermont audience?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well,
maybe they're...
Let's hear some more of your other approaches to music.
Well, we're talking about language. Let's play another plunderphonic-based piece. Let me go back to this one here. No, let's
rattle some more cellophane.
Yeah, let's listen to the distal version. There's a shorter version on here and a different thing. This piece is called The Case of Death. It's another dance piece. It's the track is not mentioned in the back of this. Track 17, the bonus track.
The bonus track, Case of Death.
And the Case of Death exists in 25 chapters. I guess we'll hear a couple of chapters for now.
Hey, here it comes, by John Oswald.
The Case of Death by Agatha Smith.
Now, then, to begin with, there was what I can only describe as a curiously eerie feeling in the air. There was,
she said,
a spot of blood,
she said,
blackmail,
she said,
proof,
she said,
the inspired guess,
she said,
a little wicked coincidence and a little dark scandal,
she said,
an enthusiastic bather, a septic finger, dried up flowers, of course, dangerous things and queer messages, and I was, in a way, mixed up in it.
Then,
now,
she paused, but at that moment,
the opportunity arose
for mystery,
murder,
and she stopped dead.
She would be, the silly creature.
Surprised by her sudden pause, Detective Frank Smile spoke. He remarked, at length.
But.
Tricks.
Stiff.
Stick.
Cropped.
Flesh.
Black.
Blunt.
Touching.
Creeps man.
Terrible.
Whistle.
Bungalow.
Boy. Girl. Dark. Dim. Slim. Someday. Dull. Darn. Do.
Oh!
Very strange indeed,
said
Mary Mead, Mabel's husband, elderly bachelor doctor, George Bather, Bucks,
and
Mrs. Ethel, Keston Spar Hydro,
and
Colonel Queer Canary,
and
Miss Helia Clump, cool, well-preserved, drew her chair a little nearer to him,
faint,
with a sigh of relief. Then,
Inspector Smith replied,
we have our little mysteries, of course.
Huh.
So she says.
Hmm. In another minute, Dr. Clutch Chance was interrupted by a big, brisk butcher, typical in hat. He was. Who'd wonder, he said gently.
I dare say she thought, poor thing, well, we needn't go into that.
He was interrupted by Miss Teaspoon Chance.
A very good-looking girl and obliging in every way,
she said. Hello.
Oh.
Hi, Scotland Yard. Yes?
No.
Well?
No.
What?
No.
You could not?
No.
Oh.
A little gasp went round the circle. Oh, however...
Ah, said the pseudo-duke. He laughed. Miss Teaspoon Chance sadly paused.
Jane chimed in. Something happened, and in cold blood, too.
Detective Blunt, slightly open to things, or something, remained, vaulted motionless beneath people below. It came from the stillness of the blinds of the ground floor rooms upstairs, unshuttered. And the eagerly expected gardener or some white girl said primly, nothing.
He said,
with a smile, suavely, I don't want this pistol of mine to go off. And now...
I began to believe that the only policy was a bold one,
he said. He drew her deftly inside an establishment of the kind indicated, and putting his hands on Miss Teaspoon Chance, a quarter of an hour later, he uttered an ejaculation of delight. Oh, she said.
I saw his mind working.
But... Then what? Said bogus inspector. Bingo, Blunt.
Nothing could have looked more accidental. Mrs. Trollope said...
That'll be the end of the case.
She smiled at him with a shudder.
She said...
I don't know why I do it, and I knew it.
She said...
I found that out. Though I admit it's only a guess, and how wicked it is and all that, but there was no proof.
She said...
I was in the drawing room with Miss Trollope, face downwards.
Several hours passed before he reappeared immediately in a somewhat futuristic dressing gown, menacingly, and disappeared through the door marked private.
Oh, why, of course, yes, that was a strange business. Go ahead, Dolly.
It was after 3 o'clock of the day before, and suddenly, and absolutely suavely, noiselessly, breathlessly, sharply, obediently, swiftly, steadily, heartily, cautiously, busily, lately, keenly, gently, slowly, sadly, and ungrammatically. But doubtless the girl half closed his eyes, he drew his breath, and breathlessly she said,
possibly.
Thereafter things proceeded rapidly.
His wife was surreptitiously glancing at a catalogue of bulbs which had come by the late post. But then, again, before, and once more,
he remarked, it is for more, which far, thud, faint, swift, dropped, when done, she's dagger, down, dress, parted, police, horror, dazed, business, gesture, that white in daily, dress, doors, dance.
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it?
Anyway.
Well, you'd better tell it, dear.
The room opposite, the stillness of the step, upstairs, unshuttered, from the cases in the corner, covered by a man's hair, leaning up against the door in the opposite wall, the position of which was carried out in a bold design, but on the left-hand side, there was more red, of a jewelled and wide down, things clean, curious, in a low, nothing, corresponding piece to the missing, than there should have been. And the patterns seemed to have got mixed.
I think I must try and make my explanation a little more subtle,
he remarked. Pink curtains rattled just across the passage. A bell rang up a flight of stairs and into a room to be at the back of the queer blinds of clear. But this particular window upstairs, unshuttered, in appearance switch deep projections into velvet pile. In addition, corner to the side of the house pointed upward, dimmed some steps in her hand. The secret wood square box band, motionless, little, typical, several things, is a small, white, underground position den. Dark dot and glared at the guest with lifted eyebrows. Contents filled the room in her hand. Then the latter sat down on a hard chair, looking through cunningly contrived peepholes, banging valuable jewels till the police come, completely unconscious of the fact Nurse Smith dropped, palpitating sighs, awaiting presently a suitable moment. And...
presently, the police came at last.
Aha, replied baffled, bogus inspector. Bingo, Bailey, Blunt, banging, busily baffled, bogus inspector, Blackbeard, butcher, Blitz, Betts, Ford, behind him. But at that moment...
the opportunity arose...
for mystery.
Murder.
And... wait a minute.
Dolly? Then?
Suddenly. Anyway.
Presently.
What? Replied Detective Frank Smile.
Mrs. Trollope said...
Hands up! And the Duke sprang forward with a pad and pencil and drew a breath of relief. He strode across to the door as the door...
Over there?
Behind them. The door into the door of this stood with his door ajar. But standing in the doorway by the communicating door to the door in the opposite wall, the position of which, as the door opened, was entering up to the front door, the door appeared. Proceeding. An inner door led in a secret drawer to a back doorknob. In the other door, closed in little doors. And there's another door, purposely a little ajar, closed door. Then passing out through the doorway, slightly open, closed, opened it carefully, closed again, and opened the door. He paused on the threshold. Then with a laugh, he sprang back.
And once more.
The Duke sprang forward, propelled.
Right over London.
Mrs. Trollope said.
A fine view.
So she says.
She said. Now look here.
Of course, it's splendid.
He remarked.
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? But then.
Agatha spoke.
As I say.
She said.
I was so sure. But,
Doctor Chance clutched Bingo by the arm.
As a matter of fact, I have something up my sleeve.
He said with a smile.
Well...
She said, breathlessly.
Ooh.
Oh!
How horrible! Wasn't it?
Suddenly, after lunch, Agatha said...
I've thought of something.
Huh.
Yes.
What? But one word had caught the other's attention.
Indigestion.
She passed. She paused. She whispered. It's her.
She sighed.
Oh,
surely, dear.
She paused. She passed. She's dead, she said.
She said...
All right, he said. She said... Oh, Charles.
The garden.
With violence.
She sighed.
She paused.
She stopped.
Then paused. She paused. And slowly, but...
Presently.
He poured him a cup of tea.
Etc. But the very next day...
Suddenly. This just opened... Right.
But.
It. Left. More. For. Which. He. Knew. Is. It. One.
Before.
Why?
Peak. Proof. Plump. Think. Point. Parallel. Two. She paused.
He said.
But what could I do?
Then.
Then.
She said.
But you know what I mean.
She said.
I'd change everything.
She said.
And what happened?
She paused. She said.
The result came as a shock to me.
She said.
And the final coincidence.
Said Agatha. She said. She said.
With a sigh of relief.
Was.
She sighed. She paused.
At that moment, he spoke the last words nimbly, with a sinister relish. It is...
Oh, now, I should just like to say this. The end.
Bravo. Okay, you've got a sense of humor, though. I Do we listen to it with, you know, with that wryness? Are we supposed to hear that? And what? And how many listenings do we get of it? And what are you doing? What do you ultimately hope we hear on this, you know, 27th listening?
Well, I don't know what you're supposed to do, but it seems fairly obvious to me that if you're making something that's going to go on a CD, and in this case. This piece is a bit of a hybrid in that it exists as two dance solos that were initiated and choreographed by the guy who's now the head of the National Ballet here in Canada, James Kadelka. So it does have in its originals some pacing that kind of thinks, well, people are going to laugh, and you need that kind of live comics kind of pause, little spaces where the laughter can happen before the next bit of dialogue comes in. It's a bit difficult in a tape piece. You have to kind of second guess what an audience might want to do. But as a record, it can be something that hopefully will be played again and again. And so I don't shy away from complexity in records. Because you can always go over the material. I do shy away from things like repeats, because, again, you can just play the thing over and over again. I think in a lot of cases you can pack a lot more information on a CD by just programming in the repeats. For instance, with traditional classical music, the reason the repeats were there is because quite often the audience would only hear that piece once in their life. And in order to get through, let's say, the variations, they'd have to hear the theme a couple of times in order to remember it. That's not the case anymore.
Do you laugh when you do this? Or is it just too much work?
Oh, yeah, I'm entertained by various things I do. There's no stipulation to laugh, though, and I really dread this idea of saying, hey, here's a funny piece, you're going to really like this. You just present the thing, and if people think it's funny, fine. Sometimes people think the oddest things are funny. You know, somebody's crying and somebody else is laughing.
Piece we've often played. Let's jump into that. That's very different.
Spectre.
Mm-hmm. First piece I heard of yours, Knock Me Over.
It was the first piece I wrote for a live performing ensemble in... it was done in 1990, I think, and it was the first one since about 1976 or 1978. And I really, although I didn't have that many offers in between, avoided creating works for live ensembles. I did some choreographed pieces that, in all cases, they tended to kind of challenge the whole idea of performance. Something I had to consider carefully when I got this invitation from Kronos as to whether I wanted to get back into making pieces for performance. Because I guess the thing I avoided in performance, just in the same way that Kamla Nancarrow did, was the imprecision of my compositional intent with the result. But I accepted the Kronos Commission, and I did it in a way with this trepidation that the performers might not do what I want on stage. So in Spectre, the tape element, which is, I think, would be expected of me to do something that was tape and live performers, is the dominant element. What Kronos is... and any other string quartet performing this work do more so than anything is provide a visual element which helps you get through the tape. They're also part of a very large, eventually a very large orchestra of string players. Kronos played all the parts for the tape section, and they're progressively multiplied as the piece goes on. So at a certain point there are 4,000 strings, mm-hmm. or 1,000 string quartets. And what you get in performance are four people sitting on stage surrounded by 4,000 mirrored images of what they're doing. So built into the piece was a lot of safeguards for any kind of eventuality of performance individuality. Since doing that piece, I've done several pieces for Kronos and for other groups in which the players get to do more.
I want to play that now. I guess there's your own preference would be to have everyone be hearing this live because of the visual elements and of course the loudness, I suppose, at the peak of it.
It's a very strange record, and not of all the things that I've played for you, it's the one that I would least recommend because it's not a circumstance that I'd control. What you have on the Spectre recording is a very dry image of the elements of all the strings. This is intentionally recorded in an anechoic, semi-anechoic situation, so that when it's reproduced on stage, it only takes advantage of the acoustics of the hall and doesn't have that sense of a room within the speakers that you're listening to from the audience. That's part of creating the illusion that all the music you're hearing is right there. There was another more extreme case where I recreated the image of an orchestra, of a pit orchestra, for a ballet piece in Berlin a few years ago. And the speakers were situated in the pit. For the audience, there was this sense, oh yes, the orchestra's in the pit, but then strange things started happening to the orchestra. At one point, they were attacked by a lion. The same thing applies in Spectre and a few other recordings I've done for reproduction in places. The original sound is, in a sense, in a no space, and the space is created in the room. So what you have on the record is this kind of in-your-face reproduction of the strings, which is nice in itself. But it's a very difficult piece, I think, to read without the dynamics, which are beyond the capability of a CD.
And, of course, in this particular case, we're also going to have the compressor on the transmitter that takes over.
There have been live recordings of Spectre. And there have been ones where the recording unit has tried to get the live sound of the string quartet on top, as like, you know, things are supposed to be. Performer and tape pieces are supposed to be like concerti. You know, the performer is the focus. In this case, the performers aren't the focus. They're just four amongst 4,000. So it's a piece that can easily be misconstrued outside of that performance context, but it does exist on record, and people listen to it, and as I mentioned to you, it's in Hollywood movies and things now, and there it is.
Here it is. Spectre by John Oswald.
listen to them, Linda. We just pretend to listen to them. And then these guys act really knowledgeable after.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're back. We're pretending to be knowledgeable. That was John Oswald Spector, flattened out, dried out, made into a husk of its original self. Okay, tell us about...
I should come out with an announcement saying, well, we're not going to play Spector just because the composers seem to be so pained about the idea of it being broadcast yet again.
That's why you're here, for pain purposes. Tell us about improvisation.
Well, instead of playing Spector, let's insert here, we could play track one from Disco Sphere, which is called Skindling Shadies, which is based on the same overall design, which is just the tsunami, the big wave. But instead of being a string quartet, all the elements are fire.
Being that we operate often in the pluperfect tense, we can have already done that. We will have being to have done that. So those listening audience who think they may have heard Spector will have heard it at a later time, assuming they have not already heard it.
Yeah. You've mentioned that you've played it on your show already. And it being a new music show, I ran into this in discussions for programming recently. The idea that if we're presenting new music, we should always be presenting new music, and there should be no historical basis or no repeats of material.
Oh, we repeat. We believe in that.
Okay.
We're recursive, too. Tell us about improvisation.
They ask questions like this. Tell us about your music.
Yeah, tell us about your music. Tell us about your dress.
Okay, improvisation and me, if I can limit
and
it
you.
A bit. Improvisation for me is very much a hobby. As might be apparent, I spend long hours in the studio working on these compositions. Then for social satisfaction and the satisfaction of getting a minute's worth of music done in a minute's worth of activity. I'm involved in several groups playing improvised music. I'm also involved in a kind of improvised dance that's a bit like wrestling. And it's a nice respite from talking to machines all day.
Like us.
Yeah.
That's it?
No. Ask him something else. Threaten him.
What about your early life? Did you take harmonica lessons as a youth?
Don't remember.
Is there anyone who might remember? Could we phone anyone and ask?
There's been various biographic attempts, most of which are extremely inaccurate. And
inaccuracy doesn't bother us particularly.
Well, it doesn't bother me either, because I like the contradictions that have come up. You know, so far I've been born in three different countries over a range of about 20 years. And the historical perspective is shaping up very nicely without any help from me.
That's good, an elusive quality.
Elusive, yes. Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy being elusive?
Sure, yeah.
Like
yeah,
it?
Good. No, no, no. Linda's turn?
Made that one short.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, let's sort of see if we can frame this somehow. I don't think we have a perspective of you in the short time as a composer, as a creator, any of these things. It seems that they slip out the side of the question sometimes. Why don't you ask yourself a question?
Well, that's not going to help.
A message. Everybody sort of has a message of some sort. that
John, is it time to go now? Oh, yes, it is. I did have an answer, but I forgot it. I mean, it wasn't even an answer because you were not asking a question. So something with this. Oh, yes, this elusive thing. If anything, I prefer not to be on center stage for any of these things. You know, the pieces are the interesting thing, and I end up just having to do some PR for these various things, which is why I talk about them. But it's not really in the attempt to build up some sort of character or character reference. It's just hopefully initiating some sort of interest in listening to the things.
You've done a very different work.
I mean, different from the rest of everything, or
yeah,
each one's different from its...
Different, sort of the character of this is different from large body of what one considers composers of new music doing. Are you a groundbreaker? You have a sort of a marker you're putting out for sort of a stream of music? See, we can come along and see it on the riverbank.
Well, I think of a distinction, which there's two ways of doing music. One is just for personal satisfaction, and a lot of that can be extremely redundant to what other people do for their own personal satisfaction. I potentially could derive a lot of satisfaction from sitting and playing sheet music of some well-known piece of music. As it turns out, I can't do that. I'm very a bad reader and a bad interpreter and all those things. So in a way, I'm kind of stuck with my own idiosyncrasies for making music. But as a producer of music or as a disseminator of music, it seems the only reasonable thing to do is fill in the gaps of things that haven't been done. And the selfish reason I do that is because I want to listen to these things. It seems like the only reason I do a project is because I want to listen to something and somebody hasn't already done it. If they've already done it, it's great. It's not like, oh, I wish I had done that, because there's lots of other things to do. It's, you know, I can spend 15 minutes and go down the store and spend $15 and get it, rather than, you know, spending the next year of my life trying to make this thing. So the things are idiosyncratic only in that they tend not to duplicate other stuff that's already available.
And your historical place, can we do it?
Filling in those minor cracks that it still exists in the availability of music. I mean, as we mentioned before, there's just so much stuff around already, and so much of it hasn't even been listened to, that there's no huge group.
I've listened to them.
Yes. It keeps mentioning this. This comment is quite suspect, but you guys are in charge of this show?
We really aren't. We're beholden to
many forces.
Many.
Yes. Including our guests. What shall we wrap up with? Last thing to listen to.
Okay. Category?
Category. Music.
For music. 15 points.
Genre of music?
Yes.
You guys aren't helping. We're trying to narrow this.
How about a recent orchestral piece that was co-written, for which we have in this very room five willing voices able to transport our listening audience? If the score has been brought, the score has not been brought, so never mind.
Well, unfortunately, you haven't introduced a wrap-up item, because, again, this piece, as referred to, which is composed by myself and Linda Caitlin Smith, who's also in the room, and I probably always pronounce her name, because it should be Catlin, right? Yeah, because, you know, it's got like a double consonant after the vowel. Linda Caitlin Smith. I just call her Linda, so I call her Linda Schmidt quite often. Smith is such a common name. And she's so un-German that it's called Orchestral Tuning Arrangement. And like Spectre, it's a piece that you really have to go and sit with lots of other people and experience it. Need we say more? It's a terrible wrap-up item, because it's...
We're going to do it then.
Okay.
We're going to wrap it up. We're going to thank you.
Please go hear Orchestral Tuning Arrangement at your local symphony.
Coming soon.
Hopefully.
Our guest today on the Galveston Damien New Music Bazaar, John Oswald. Thank you.
Thank you.
Skindling Shadies, music by John Oswald.
What happened to orchestral tuning arrangements?
Well, that was apparently a bit of a bootleg tape to which we were not given access.
Oh, how shame. Don't they realize that we would take the utmost of good care of it?
I don't think care was the issue. I think perhaps performance rights and the contorted nostrils of the unpaid performers might have something to do with it.
Such as us.
So, well, no, we're unpaid by volunteer, not by bootleg. Nobody loots our bags.
They could.
They can, but they don't. Oh. For any reason, let's take it up to the hour with one more piece from Disco Sphere. By the way, he's, as we, I think, made clear, is a bit elusive from time to time.
Maybe.
Yes, however, there are notes to the compact disc, and Skinling Shady's, what we just heard, says, coincidentally, the composer was gathering recordings of incendiary sounds at the same time co-choreographers Paula Ravitz and Denise Fujiwara were working on a solo of combustible images while using as rehearsal music the recording of Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird. The co-choreographers asked John Oswald to make a replacement to The Firebird, and he had no intention to imitate Stravinsky. In addition to actual fire recordings, there are similar sounds, the moving of air, the escaping of gases, the fracture of timber, trompe l'oreille, and heat noise swarms.
I see.
So shall we listen to yet another? This one's called VT. I thought it might have meant Vermont, but it has something to do with television backwards. So here it is, VT by John Oswald. There it is. VT followed by Beat by John Oswald.
Veet Beat.
Who was our guest during the past 2 weeks of the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar.
And indeed, the interview seemed to take that long during the process.
During the real life process. Yes, he was a particularly reticent interviewee. I was considering that the two plunder phoniobes that we interviewed, Oswald and the other fellow who doesn't call himself an exponent of plunder phonics, and that is Nick Collins, were both extremely difficult to draw out about what they do. Guilt?
Exactly, yes. More of that young composer on the moped pushing an out of gas moped with a broken 8-track player.
Yes, with an X on the end of the where the spot is marked. Let's listen to some of our new releases here on the Calvos and Damien New Music
Bazaar. I can't wait. You were starting to preview one of these, and I guess you found a likely candidate.
The least offensive. This is a WGDR. Plainfield. You're probably also hearing us on another station. We welcome once again WOMR in Provincetown, Massachusetts, to our listening family, or shall we call it at this part, our listening sibling.
The bastard son.
It could be that. From the new release from Stuart Saunders Smith, someone who we played before and took off halfway through in gales of laughter and howls of derision.
We'll who, us?
Never that. With, this is a new release. This one this time is called Wind in the Channel.
Oh, good. Preface the music, though.
I don't think so. I won't prejudge. After all, I did listen to at least 2 or 3 seconds of the beginning of each cut before selecting this one.
Number 9, I can...
It is Aussie Blue, Paul Hoffman on the piano playing music of Stuart Saunders Smith. You never can trust those guys with 3 names.
Well,
it's happening again! I can't get through it!
just play the introduction to cut 8. Just to give us perspective.
When they start singing along with the piano and like these bad performance voices, it's like, welcome back to the 1970s! Let's hum along.
There. Maybe is there a 10th cut?
There's not. We only have a minute and a half left of this to go. Well, let's get out of the way of it.
We went to the store for Pop. Couldn't.
Oh, that's it.
Yeah, I just wanted to play that first part.
Yes, well, there it is. Aussie Blue, the anagram to that is "You is Bus Flea." Music.
Air quotes.
By Stuart Saunders Smith. I guess so. Well, let's turn to something else a little bit more interesting and let it play through to the end.
Oh, good.
This is actually...
you're not playing that lovely little short turnaround thing at 33 RPM?
We have that. That was going to save those to the end because some music by coming up. Which is very, very hard to find. We played Powerhouse and a few other very, very interesting pieces by Raymond Scott from the 1940s and 50s, but he was also a very innovative electronic composer, and almost none of his music has ever been heard of that electronic era. Some tapes survive, and they were recently put out on a little, what do you call those things that are 7-inch LPs? I guess that's what you call them. Anyway, we've got one of those, a limited release, private recording of the music of Raymond Scott. We'll come up with that toward the end of the program. For the moment, we've got a very fine little piece called This Time by Anne Southam. This is a new release by Ardaliana. That's piano, cello, and flute ensemble on a CD called Spinners of Starlight. So this is music by Anne Southam, whose interview is yet to be heard on our show and will be heard upcoming this summer.
Next week.
Is it? No, that's Elma Miller is next week. Yes, that's what we should say. Elma Miller will be joining us next week on The Bazaar, and Anne Southam later this year.
And Elma will be bringing some of her scores. She's a music transcriptionist.
Yes, an engraveress.
Engraveress. We'll be able to hold those up to the microphone for all to see.
That's indeed true. Isn't that sort of like German, engravers, engrafin? That would be an encountess, or an accountant. She's a musical accountant. Oh, well, never mind. Music by Anne Southam. This is This Time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Interesting acoustics to that recording as well.
Yes.
You hear the subway or something going by toward the end. That was music by Anne Southam called This Time, performed by the Ardalana Ensemble. That was recorded in Humbercrest United Church in Toronto. What a nice name, Humbercrest. The CD is called Spinners of Starlight.
We haven't had her on yet, have we?
Not yet. Soon. Soon this summer. Let's turn to some Raymond Scott. Raymond Scott, known for Powerhouse. I just read an article in a magazine about people got together and talked about what things they loved and what things they hated. And on the love list was Powerhouse by Raymond Scott. So I guess it's got to be Baby Boomer Hip.
Ooh.
Yeah. But we're not going to listen to that. Instead, we're going to hear an untitled electronic piece and then another electronic piece called The Happy Whistler. He developed a very large automated composing machine, which he actually never got to complete, never got to make work. But in the process of doing that, he did a lot of development of original electronic modules. And this is in the late 1940s and 1950s when these were almost incomprehensible. The machine, the automatic composing machine, pretty much filled a room, and it had beautiful mahogany cabinets. It was quite a wonderful piece, and we don't actually have any examples of even any attempts with that. But what we do have are Untitled and Happy Whistler and Untitled number 2, and we'll hear all three of those cuts, and then we'll flip over this lovely little 7-inch LP and listen to Untitled number 4. Really, really keen little electronic pieces by Raymond Scott.
He's no longer around, is he?
He's no longer around. He apparently was very disturbed about the quality of his own music and decided that he needed to remove himself from the milieu of the composing world in a kind of a physical way.
Oh, these things happen.
So they do. Music by Raymond Scott in a way you've not heard him before.
The simple thing.
Yeah, what? That was the Happy Whistler, or that was Untitled Number Two, Number Three, Untitled Number Three, Raymond Scott from Giardia Records in Minneapolis, or Gateway Music, recorded around 1960, and the Happy Whistler was excised from a stereo master to the mono Soothing Sounds for Baby, which was an LP from 1963. And now, Untitled Number Two by Raymond Scott.
Experiment 2 and 3rd.
Quality electroacoustic music back when diodes were diodes. And
yes.
Vacuum and tubes were vacuum tubes.
Right, and transistors were just little puny things you could hold into your hand, and they didn't tell you how many millions of them were on a chip.
That's right.
That's right, because there was only one. They were lonesome. They deserved it. Music by Raymond Scott. All together there, we heard the Untitled's 1, 2, 3, and 4 with a Happy Whistler excerpted in the middle from Soothing Sounds for Baby, a 1963 LP on that one. Which, of course, brings up the question of elevator music. I think one of these days we should actually look up all of the versions of elevator music that have been created which were not, shall we say, arrangements of
your standard Muzak trademark. could be an interesting concept, an interesting idea for a show. What do you think?
I'm always eager for elevator music.
Indeed. Well, that's the Calvis and Damian New Music Bazaar for today, show number 107,
assuming we have someone to follow in our footsteps.
We do.
Which suddenly seems to be the dead zone on WGDR Plainfield.
Well, no more dead zone. We're going to put on some Nick Collins in one of the other non-plunderphonic versions of plunderphonic-type technique.
Yeah.
Let's take somebody else's stuff and do something with it.
Right.
And we'll be back next week with an interview with Elma Miller, unless we get somebody real live in the studio. But in the meantime, here's music by Nick Collins.
Devil's Music.
A production of Multimedia.